on every phase space, and I suggested to you to think in slightly more abstract mathematical terms about it. Now, what we had already seen is that this symplectic structure really endows the space of functions on phase space with a Lie algebra structure. And by virtue of this map we had of mapping each function to a unique associated Hamiltonian vector field, these vector fields actually also inherit the Lie algebra structure with respect to just the commutators on vector fields. OK, then we asked ourselves, well, what happens with a Hamiltonian system when we have gauge symmetry around? And I gave you a brief derivation from a Lagrangian system that had such a gauge symmetry, and that was actually translates into the statement of having a singular Lagrangian, which I defined yesterday. Now, how when you perform kind of a standard Legendre transformation from such a singular structure, Lagrangian structure, then I showed you that in general you will pick up a number of constraints, and these constraints are just algebraic equations that have to be satisfied on your phase space. And the particular case that is of relevance to us and which we are looking a little more closely is that of first class constraints. So let me just briefly recap the last relations I wrote down on the board yesterday. So from now on, we'll be dealing with exclusively with first class constraint systems. And the constraints are labeled by index little a. So some functions that have to vanish on phase space. And we have m of these relations. And what defined the first class character. So this is just a definition. And it really comes out of a classification due to Bergmann and Dirac is the following property. Two constraints on the constraint, two constraints can be written again as the Poisson bracket of those can be written as a linear combination of the same constraints. And that was equivalent to saying they actually, so they have to vanish on the constraint surface. And this is the kind of this weak equality sign I introduced. And what also had to be the case, kind of in order to deal consistently with the dynamics of these systems, is that the Poisson bracket of the Hamiltonian that comes with your system with each one of these constraints also has to vanish, vanish weakly. So this used this weak equality sign. That means equality on the constraint surface defined by the simultaneous vanishing of these relations. OK, so there's yet another way of phrasing it to say, aha, now all of these, when I sit on the constraint surface, all of these Poisson commute. So this has a bunch of non-trivial implications. One of them being, I just mentioned that in passing, you can think of them, these here, as kind of forming a set, say, of momenta alone or of coordinates alone. Because, of course, think of the canonical commutation relation you have on a phase space. So, you know, any pair of Q's, of course, Poisson commutes. Any pair of P's, Poisson commutes. So you only ever get non-trivial contributions in kind of cross terms where you have a Q, you know, Poisson commuting with some P. So that possibly can be non-zero. But if you just, so actually locally, one can actually rephrase that if one wants to. One can locally actually find coordinates so that, say, the first M momenta or coordinates, as you wish, coincide with these phis. So they are just a bunch of m independent directions. And what we've also already seen is that when these relations are true, then the dynamics is consistent in the sense that if you follow the flow of the Hamiltonian, which of course you want to do, I mean, this is just what gives you the time evolution of the system, it will not take you away from your constrained surface. And similarly, if you look at kind of the integral curves of the associated Hamiltonian vector fields of these phi, they also will leave you in the constrained surface. So really, all interesting dynamics can be discussed on this constrained surface. Now, what we have already seen, what is also a non-trivial consequence of the setup, and maybe I should write it on the board here, I call this first-class constraints strike twice. What do I mean by that? Well, firstly, they reduce it to a submanifold of the phase space. And secondly, they induce on that reduced surface, on this constraint surface, they induce gauge equivalence. Namely, that any two points that can be related by kind of flowing along kind of the flow lines of these the vector fields associated with these constraints, so these other kind of the gauge directions, leaves physics unchanged. So and also when you kind of do a degree of freedom counting, really you should kind of from your the dimension of your phase space for each one of the first class constraints, you should subtract kind of two in terms of dimension of phase space. So how did this go? So first, of course, the presence of each constraint will constrain us to a subspace. And so the joint subspace on which the constraints are satisfied are called SC. And it has dimension 2n minus m, where 2n was the original dimension of the original phase space, and m the number of independent such constraints. And secondly, now the presence of these constraints induces effoliation of the constraint surface. I'll make a little picture in a second into gauge orbits. And each of the gauge orbits has dimension m. So again, how did this look? So this is my box here. This was schematically my phase space. I'm not drawing this very well. Now I have here this submanifold SC. This is SC. And now what I'm saying is that if I look at now at if I'm anywhere on this SC and I follow the flow of any of the Hamiltonian vector fields associated with any of the constraints, then I will reach, I can integrate them up, actually, by virtue of the fact that these are in evolution. That tells me that at least locally, I can integrate them up. So they form then these gauge orbits of dimension m. And if you know the action is well behaved, so this kind of looks similar in every point of phase space, which we'll assume, then you get this nice foliation of this entire space SC, into orbit, so each one is of dimension m. So that's the picture I already drew yesterday. So each one of these is a each orbit. And of course, the usual interpretation being that points along gauge orbits are physically equivalent. So what one actually wants to do, therefore, one wants to look at the space of gauge orbits, so where really all you think of each orbit now as a point, and the point now lives in what is called the reduced phase space, so or the physical or reduced, it's also often called phase space. And this is given by kind of it's a space of equivalence classes. So I'm writing it like that. And by this, I mean to indicate that whenever two points happen to lie on the same gauge orbit, I identify them. So that induces this equivalence relation. And here, more specifically, it takes the form of such a foliation. And of course, the dimensionality of the space is now 2n minus 2m of this physical reduced. So, sorry, I give that a name, S phys. So, this is what I said initially. So, quite literally, for any one of these constraints, you subtract 2 from the dimension of the original phase space. And of course, like in the simple example we looked at yesterday, one could immediately kind of read off what this physical phase space was and what a nice parameterization, as that it had a nice parameterization. Now, other important objects on SC are all phase space functions that are invariant along the gauge orbits. And why are they specifically important? Because they will project down to this quotient space, S phys. So they will have a well-defined meaning. Whatever is constant along orbits, like by definition, my Hamiltonian will project down in a nice way to the physical configuration space. So that's here, distinct points correspond to distinct physics. So this is exactly what we want to look at as our kind of physical space. So physical observables in this context are just some phase space functions F. Of course, I only look at them reduced on this constraint surface. That's where they interest me. And by definition, they satisfy F Poisson bracket with each of the constraints has to be weakly equal to zero. So it has to vanish on the constraint surface. And of course, that immediately, I mean, this condition, of course, implies that, well, it implies two things. So it implies that kind of the Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to this constraint, to each one of them applied on F, is weakly equal to zero. So that's, yeah. So this is just the constancy of this function along the gauge orbits when you sit on SC. So that's transparent. So F projects in an unambiguous manner kind of a well-defined function on the physical phase space. Now, this whole discussion, especially kind of in finite dimensions, that's an old and very long story. So depending, you can then distinguish various kind of many, many subtleties, well, that do actually also appear in some real life systems, depending on how nicely kind of these gauge symmetries act on your configuration space. So that there are various ways that could, for instance, variations that could happen here. So what might be the case is that actually the constraints are not all independent. So of course, then the reduction, they reduce you by fewer dimensions, effectively. It can also happen that the orbits don't all look the same. So then somehow you get kind of degeneracies in the quotient space. So there are loads and loads of things you might discuss. Not particularly relevant for us, but there's also a lot of that has also been studied by geometers, differential geometers. Anyway, for us, some important references on this entire subject are old lecture notes by Dirac. They're called Lectures on Quantum Mechanics, 1964. And they deal, just with these issues. So it's not general quantum mechanics, but it's really, you know, quantum mechanics in the presence of constraints. And written with his trademark absolute clarity. There is a very nice and very useful book by Kurt Sundermeyer that appeared in 1982. It's called Constraint Systems, and it appeared in Lecture Notes in Physics. And what makes it so incredibly useful is that he does all these things very explicitly, and he goes through a number of examples, including also gravity, making kind of this constraint analysis and also relating it to more kind of a mathematically minded formulation. Now, then lastly, there is a whole book that deals with, on very many pages, with the dynamics of constraint systems by Hinault and the person formerly known as Teitelbaum. This is quantization of gauge systems. This book appeared in 1994. And this, well, it starts out kind of a la Dirac, just analyzing these finite dimensional examples, but then very quickly also has an exhaustive treatment of the field theoretic case and all kind of special subtleties that can appear, and includes also a discussion about VRST quantization, which is actually rather closely related to some of these structures that appear here. Okay, now of course we are not interested in, I've given you kind of a glimpse of what this entails, these first class constraints, and that is exactly the case that's relevant for gravity, and that of course has our specific interests here. And it's quite interesting that these early considerations, like, you know, the 50s of last century, as I said, I mean, Dirac was a crucial person involved, Peter Bergmann was another crucial person involved, they were really motivated by trying to understand and also canonically quantize gravity. So that is what the primary motivation was for getting into this analysis of constraint systems. Okay, so what we are now turning back to. Canonical gravity. In other words, the canonical formulation to start with, of course, of the classical theory of general relativity. Now, what was underlying the entire discussion, including kind of the explicit examples I gave here of constrained Hamiltonian systems, was the existence that was assumed throughout of a notion of time. And where's an obvious place where this appears? Well, an obvious place is when I write, canonically conjugate momentum is dl by dq dot. So that refers to time. Now, when we get to gr, there is no, to start with, no distinguished notion of time. But nevertheless, it turns, we'll have to choose, we'll have to make a choice in order to proceed with this scheme, in order to kind of Legendre transform. But it's really an initially arbitrary choice one is making in order to be able to apply this formalism. And of course, then you have to think later on, how the arbitrariness with respect to that choice, how that is then reflected in the properties of the eventual formulation. First classically, but then of course also quantum mechanically. Now, for what one does here, one proceeds as follows. So let me now imagine I am given a four-dimensional manifold M and some Lorentzian metric. And as before, topologically, that's what I had already mentioned this before. I'm assuming this is also a form of a direct a product. And well, for simplicity, in this kind of classical discussions, one very often assumes also that the spatial slices, sigma, are actually compact. So that simplifies things. You don't have to discuss boundary terms at infinity and such like. OK, now what we do here is, in order to be able to go to a Hamiltonian picture, we choose a global time function. So let me just call it a T in such a way that M is foliated into what's called Cauchy surfaces or Cauchy hypersurfaces. Now, what does this entail? So first of all, I have kind of a nice slicing of my space. And each slice I can label by this global T parameter. Each slice, by definition, is a Cauchy surface. That means giving initial data on that surface, you can uniquely evolve to create the entire space-time here. So the picture, of course, that one draws. Maybe I should go to this blackboard again. So my big M. Here. So here I have, I'm picking out a bunch of slices, spatial slices, and well, they were slices that are called sigma, so I can just now label them by the global time parameter. So time goes like this. And well, a quantity we'll need in a second. It's kind of a normal vector on each of these slices at every point, of course. Now, two things to be noted here. So there is no claim that this T is physically distinguished in any way. So why do I want this? So that's my first remark. So T has no immediate physical meaning, apart from providing you with this slicing into spatial hypersurfaces. And secondly, I mean, this splitting up and what we are about to do, of course, explicitly breaks the four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance, right? Because this slicing will not be preserved under general diffeomorphisms. And that's, of course, a hallmark of now the Hamiltonian formulation. So the diffeomorphism symmetry is no longer manifest, you know, in the same way as we said in relativistic quantum field theory. If I go to a Hamiltonian formulation, then Lorentz invariance is no longer manifest. Of course, you should build it into the theory, but it will not be so obvious that this invariance holds. So you have to do some extra work to make sure it does. So okay, I have already introduced this little normal vector, so that there is, of course, one in each space-time point x. And since it's normal on spatial slices, well, this is a time-like vector satisfying n mu scalar product with itself equal to minus 1. So that's the definition of the unit vector. Now, and well, once you have the slicing given, of course, you had your original G mu nu. That was part of our starting data. Now, that will induce a metric on a spatial metric on each one of these hypersurfaces. Because I know how to measure distances in the big space. Of course, I also know how to measure distances if I stay completely within a single one of these spatial slices. So we get an induced 3-metric metric on each of these surfaces sigma t. And it's given by, I call this little h mu nu, and it's obtained by adding or subtracting, whichever way you want to look at it, a term bilinear in this unit vector. And it's straightforward to see, kind of, it's easy to see that this is a purely spatial quantity because, say, I multiply this relation through by an n mu with an upper index, I get, on the right-hand side, I get n mu h mu nu. On the left-hand side, rather, sorry. And on the right-hand side, I get the n with the index downstairs. Then I get an n mu, index contracted, which is minus 1 by definition. So I get an n mu, and this is 0. And of course, that's this type of situation you already met in Bruce Gregory's lectures. Right, this kind of looking at structures that are induced on a submanifold, not necessarily a hypersurface like here. Hypersurface means it has codimension 1 or dimension d minus 1, but also lower dimensional objects. And you can analyze various properties how kind of the embedding relates to the entire the larger geometry. And this object here is, well, it's induced symmetric. It also goes by the name of first fundamental form. So if you look back in your notes, you for sure find it there. So what one now in the next step wants to do is to rewrite kind of the degrees of freedom that sit in G menu. You want to rewrite them as stuff that depends on H menu, or rather the non-vanishing spatial components, let me call them HIJ, plus other data. So that's the starting point kind of for the canonical picture. So what one does, one considers, in order to understand what is a nice and natural way of performing such a parameterization, one looks at a situation where one has two infinitesimally adjacent slices. So this is a slice sigma t, and let this be the slice sigma t plus dt. So a small interval of this coordinate time apart. So the next slice here. Now, what I'm interested in is to find a nice expression for the physical, the true distance, so the geodesic distance between two points, nearby points on these adjacent slices. Okay, so this point below here I call xi t, and this point up here is just xi plus del dxi and t plus dt. So what I'm interested in is, as I said, the proper distance, ds, between these two points, x mu txi and x mu plus del x mu, which explicitly I have already written down there, t plus dt xi plus dxi. Now, what I'm going to be using to express this infinitesimal proper distance is kind of a Lorentzian version of Pythagoras' theorem. And we'll see kind of what additional data are necessary beyond what is contained in the metric information on a fixed three-dimensional slice to parameterize this distance here. Okay. So the first thing what I'll be looking at actually is, first I erect here on this, starting on this point, I erect a normal. Okay, so it's kind of, it's perpendicular on this lower surface. So I say I walk along my little n mu in this direction. And now here, what is the distance between these two points? Well, the coordinate distance is t. The proper distance in terms of geodesic time, d tau, is given by n dt. Right, so this is just kind of the factor, the proportionality factor between the coordinate distance, which is just this arbitrary t, and kind of the true geometric distance, which I would call d tall, yeah, in this case. So that's one thing. Now, another thing to note is that, well, if I make this construction, kind of if I erect kind of perpendicularly here this line, in general, where I will end up will not be a point that has the same spatial coordinate xi. But what is the most general case is that, well, it will be kind of shifted to the right or the left. Now, this is just a question of what was the coordinate system I had here in the first place. So in general, this point here will have coordinates xi. Now I'm parameterizing where kind of how far it's been removed from the point that is called xi also on this upper surface. And I'm introducing something that's called the shift vector. And the t is, of course, the t plus dt. So you see, I have introduced two new quantities, n and ni. So this is the so-called lapse function. And this here, ni, is the shift function. So lapse just says how much proper time has elapsed as a function of this arbitrary coordinate time dt. So that's given by this n factor locally. Of course, it can vary from point to point. And this shift just tells me, well, how much my coordinate system, spatial coordinate system, has kind of shifted when I go in between adjacent slices. So let me now write, and let me apply now Pythagoras' theorem to kind of this triangle of relations. So ds squared, and now since I'm doing this the Lorentzian way, of course, kind of this time interval appears with a minus sign squared. So it's actually this, n dt all squared, plus, now what's the length of this here? I have to take the difference between these two points, you see. The t component obviously drops out, so that's fine. So this is entirely a spatial vector. The xi's also cancel each other. So I'm left with a distance that's called, that is the spatial distance dxi plus ni dt. Now, this is the infinitesimal distance when expressed in coordinates xi and t. Now, what is the true distance? Well, the true distance knows, of course, about the metric on the three geometry, which is hij. So the correct expression to write down here is plus hij, and now twice this line element, dxi plus ni dt times dxj plus nj dt. And of course, well, the n and the ni explicitly appear. And now what you've effectively done is you started from a symmetric 4x4 tensor, g mu nu. So these are 10 numbers to start with because of the symmetry. And you've replaced it by hij. That's a symmetric 3x3 matrix. So there are six. These are six numbers per spacetime point. A shift vector ni with a spatial index, 3, plus a lapse at each point, gives you one number. So this is just the number kind of accounting for degrees of freedom. Now it's straightforward to write down the explicit form of the metric. You just read it off from this infinitesimal I element, which I've just constructed for you. So G mu nu, say, if you write it now in matrix form, that's still the form metric. So you have a G naught naught, write it in kind of in this splitting up time and spatial, G naught I, G, did I want to call this J? Okay, G I naught, G I J. So here I've split up. So the zero is the time component, and now I always index with zero, and the others with I and J's. That gives, just reading off from this expression on the right-hand side for the dt part, we're getting two contributions, one from here and one from here. Right? And the contraction, now this h, this is a spatial vector. Now here, I will now pull up and down the indices with this 3 metric. Right? So when I write it, this is what this means there. Minus n squared, nj, ni, hij. And it's also straightforward. I won't write it down to work out what the inverse metric is in terms of these new variables. So in fact, now we're thinking now in the Hamiltonian picture, one is thinking of a metric spacetime in a different manner, right? Here I gave you just a G mu nu, but what this here suggests is that I'm thinking of this spacetime as, well, essentially as kind of hij propagating in time and thus kind of creating during the course of its time evolution this entire form manifold, of course subject to specific data for these laps and the shift functions. So however, what will now turn out, well, what are now my variables from the point of view of, you know, going from making the transition from Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian formalism? Well, first of all, now in the Lagrangian formalism, where we still are, these play the role of kind of the field coordinates. Then obviously, well, we still need velocity. So this essentially are just the time derivatives of these hijs. Actually, one uses a different function, which you've also already seen, which is a simple function of the h ij dots, and they're given by the vector fields k mu nu, and k mu nu is defined as follows, and I draw a picture of this, and again, this is a structure you've also already seen in your in Gregory's lectures. So what is one doing here? One looks now here at a piece of embedded slice. So that is my sigma. Now here is my normal vector at some point x. Now I'm moving along the slice itself to some other point x plus dx. And again here, of course, I have a normal and is always perpendicular by construction to my spatial slice here. Now, what I'm told to do here is to look at the covariant derivative of n and project, well, this was purely spatial, remember. So this you can see as a projection onto the spatial slice itself. So what I'm doing here, I mean, what is the covariant derivative? Here's my chalk. I'm comparing kind of what the normal is at a neighboring point, and I compare it with the parallel transported vector from the original point. So let's see, that would be something like that. So this would be my parallel transported vector, right? And then I look at the difference, the projection of the difference here on the manifold itself. On the submanifold itself. So, and you see, of course, well, this is called extrinsic curvature. So also a notion you've already heard. It is sensitive to how this surface is curved in the ambient four-dimensional geometry. Why? You see, if this was just flat, it was just flat from the point of view of the embedding, then of course there is no difference between the normal and the parallel transported normal from a neighboring point. So then the extrinsic curvature would just vanish. However, if it's kind of very bent here locally, then it's obvious that this curvature, extrinsic curvature, will become larger, right? So, yeah, so qualitatively, I mean, kind of geometrically, it's kind of clear what happens. Now, I don't know to what extent you've looked into the geometric properties. So there are two properties important for KMU nu. So although it's not immediately obvious from the definition, this is actually a symmetric tensor in the two indices. And again, it's entirely spatial. So actually, the time, any time components vanish. So it's, sorry, purely spatial. Not all of you will be able to read this. It just means if I dot it into, if I take the scalar product with a normal, contract on one of the indices of the K, and this gives me zero. So the interesting components of the extrinsic curvature are just the spatial ones. And there is yet another way kind of writing those. I won't make the derivation here because we simply don't have the time to do this. Now, it turns out this involves not just the velocity of hij, so the time derivative, but also these extra data, n and ni, Laplace and shift, make an appearance here. So this is minus di nj minus dj ni, where these here, they are now, as opposed to the nabla I was using earlier, this is now the covariant derivative with respect to the sweet geometry, so the covariant derivatives that just knows about the hij here. So it's a spatial covariant derivative. So that's kind of the velocity, or that's a nice variable to use here. So what you then do is you rewrite your Lagrangian. Let me, for the moment, drop the cosmological constant term. Its treatment is fairly trivial. So we just rewrite this. So let me just, this is 1 over 16 pi gn. So what I'm defining here is k squared, kappa squared is 16 pi gn. Just for ease of notation, I don't have to carry the pi's with me around. So I'm looking at the p's of the Lagrange density, which just knows about the four-dimensional scalar curvature. Okay, so this is just a prefactor. Now, a calculation we are not doing here yields that up to a total divergence, which I'm dropping, total divergence, this can be written as 1 divided by kappa squared, laps n, determinant of the spatial metric h, three-dimensional curvature, scalar curvature, plus kij minus k squared, where k, by definition, has its indices contracted with the spatial three metric in this expression here. OK, of course, it's a lot of algebraic manipulations cut short. But well, there's several things you should be paying attention to here. So what you see is here, you see the kij contained a velocity. So the I've now written this already in a suggestive manner. So this is my kinetic term here. This is a term where second time derivatives appear. And this is my potential term. Only spatial derivatives appear. Right? So I have now rewritten my Lagrangian in the standard manner t minus v already. Okay. So now, once I'm here, I'm all set for doing the Legendre transformation. Right? So okay, so I'm defining canonically conjugate momenta, two of them, two types. So one, now of course we are in field theory, right? So these are now functional differentials. So the first one, I take the derivative with respect to n mu dot. So what I'm doing here is I've put together the laps and the shift into something that looks like a four vector. So that is just a notation. Right? But of course, you see, neither n nor the shift ni, which is also contained in these k's, by virtue of this relation, have any time derivatives associated with them. Of course, that actually gives you already a hint that these are not genuine physical dynamical variables. So again, we are looking at a singular Lagrangian, obviously, by the same argument I was explaining yesterday. So these, of course, vanish. But the canonically conjugate momenta to the hij's do not vanish. So they are given by the partial derivatives with respect to del naught hij. And they are of the form 1 divided by kappa squared minus 1 divided by kappa squared square root of determinant h kij minus k, that is, again, so it's a trace of k, spatial trace, h by j. OK, and now we are ready to go, but not today, but tomorrow.